hi, my name is Alex Donaldson and I will be conducting this interview today on behalf of the One Another Project and the Wellcome Trust. The date is the 2nd of October 2009. If you could please state your full name, your age if that's okay, and where you're from.
My name is Neil Martin Edifford. I am 40 years old and for my sins I'm from Taunton at the moment.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yes, good to be here, even if it is at a stupid o'clock in the morning.
So can I just ask how you initially heard about the project?
I think through the media. Heard that, you know, Anthony Cornley was doing something else and the fourth plinth, and obviously, you know, lots of people have done various projects on the fourth plinth for the last several years, and heard that he was doing something, and then you could sign up to have a go, and so I signed up. And then, yes, got told about 10 days ago.
So what was it that actually inspired you to get involved?
Well, it's just a chance to actually, you know, take part in something like this. I mean, you know, when else do you get a chance to, you know, take part in, you know, a big art experiment, really? And why wouldn't you if you had the chance? Why would you not? Several of my friends I've had a fair range of comments, especially about being 3 o'clock in the morning and how ridiculous it is and all the rest of it. But they just don't understand. You know, you've got to want to, you know, get something out of life and do it. If you get an opportunity to do this, you know, there's only 2,400 of us that do, so why not?
So how did you feel when you found out you had a place?
I was working. I got phoned up in the middle of the day. Presumably, I think, because somebody else dropped out because it was 3 o'clock in the morning. They want me. And yeah, very excited. I mean, you know, the person on the end of the phone seemed surprised that I said yes. But yeah, no, superb, brilliant. Couldn't wait to tell my wife and everybody was like, yeah, delighted. So there's a lot of excited people as well. So it's quite cool.
Could I get you to talk a little bit about yourself?
Yeah.
Kind of just who you are, what you do.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm self-employed. I'm an engineer, generally by day. I fix white goods, catering equipment, that type of thing. It suits me. I have to use my brain. I get to go, you know, everywhere. I'm not going to the same place every day, and every job's different, which is fine. However, in the rest of my life, which is probably actually, certainly during the summer, even it's probably 50-50 of my time. I spend either doing talks and demonstrations or going in and teaching in schools, universities sometimes, teaching about medieval life. Many years ago, I joined an archery club, met my wife there. She wasn't my wife at the time, obviously. And then very, very quickly went from the modern target bows, went on to traditional longbows, and then started trying to make the arrows, and then started learning about the whole process, how they use, how the battles happened, and then I did a bit of blacksmithing and learned how to make some of the heads, so I've got my own forge, I can do all of that, and just went from there and ended up making all sorts of stuff, you know, leatherwork and chainmail and daggers, and you know, then anything I earn from doing the talks goes back in and I buy more equipment, and then, you know, I can do more talks for, as I say, for schools and all the rest of it. And I'm turning that more and more into a business.
Has this always been something that you've been incredibly enthusiastic about?
Well, it's over the last kind of 20 years, it's built up kind of more and more and more, and now I need another house to start putting the kids in because it's getting a bit daft now. When I was younger, no, I was just I was kind of fairly science based and did all my A levels in the sciences and didn't do that, and then really kind of got the bug for the history and the minutiae, the logistics and the technical details of how they ran an army in the medieval period. Just because they didn't have videos and fridges didn't mean they were stupid. You know, to put 8,000 to 10,000 people in the field, you need an awful lot of people behind them, feeding them and carrying their equipment and making their equipment and collecting the feathers to make the arrows. You know, if you're going off on campaign with 750,000 arrows, that's an awful lot of geese. And just how all that works, and you know, it gets some of it gets in a lot more detail than anybody else ever wants to know. But for my own benefit, I need to know these things.
So how do you, where do you draw your information from?
Oh, crumbs. Everywhere I can. There are obviously a lot of academic texts you can go to, and there's a lot of work kind of done on the period. Obviously, with a lot of the costume and some of the equipment, you go to the various, obviously, the Royal Armouries, the Wallace Collection, places like that. The National Gallery, National Portrait Gallery, for the costume and things. Obviously, we obviously don't have photos at the time. The only information we've got, especially of earlier costume and clothing and kit, is contemporary portraits. We don't have anything else. We don't have clothes really kind of pre-Tudor. So the only information you're going to get, so it, you know, it gets you into the galleries and gets you learning that way, you know. And then I get people coming to me. I'm the chairman of a large archery reenactment group, large longbow group, and we get sometimes a point comes up, and you know, well, what about earrings? Did the women wear earrings? What kind of earrings? So then you've got to start kind of going, but well, did they or not? And you know, so on our period from about 1250 to about 1480. Did they wear it? And the answer is no, but that took quite a lot of finding. Mary Queen of Scots introduced them again, if anybody's interested. But she was the one who made them fashionable. But you know, you just get asked a weird question, and then off you go on the research for hours or days or weeks to actually try and find out some weird point of, you know, that nobody seems to know, and you've just kind of got to go through all the information and dig it out. Just go back to the original source material.
What is it about the medieval period that fascinates you so much?
Phew. It's a good question. I'm interested in history generally. I've taught a little bit as a kind of guest lecturer at university on various subjects, on archaeology courses, so kind of early metalworking and that type of thing as well. I'm a romantic at heart, I think, and it's that whole kind of Gothic save the maiden bit. But I'd love to go back, but I want to take the NHS with me.
So, does your wife also share this passion?
My wife, as I say, we both joined, when we met, we both joined the archery club on the same night. That's where we met, so we've done all the shows together, we do demonstrations together. All our children come along now, so I've got a boy who's 17 and girls at 7 and now just 4. And they all shoot, and I do a lot of sword work with my son, who's very, very good, very controlled. And it's a brilliant thing to get out there and do, and especially during the summer when we're doing the shows, it's brilliant for the younger children. Obviously, my son's older now, but he's grown up doing it. And when the public go home, we get a castle to play with. I mean, literally, we stay and live in the medieval tents inside these castles, and the castle is our playground. So, you know, we get to use them, you know, as they were used. We get to shoot from all the places. Obviously, you can't shoot when the public's around. It's absolutely fantastic, you know. It's fantastic education for them and teaches them a lot of independence. And also control. You know, my seven-year-old shoots in the line. She was shooting fire arrows this year because, you know, she's learnt and grown up with it, and she's very controlled and, you know, she's a good girl.
So are you particularly interested in recreating, or do you actually seeking out kind of old medieval historical sites, or
it's kind of all of it. I mean, I suppose what I'm most into doing is learning exactly how they did things, how they made things, and how the objects were used. Unless you're trying to make the object using the same materials in the same way as they made them, you're not making the same object. When you have made that object, the way it's made actually affects its obviously its form, but also its function. And there's an awful lot of written, especially the Victorians, kind of with the whole Gothic revival and the whole medieval romance thing that they really got into. They wrote down loads of stuff, and a lot of it gets repeated and repeated. And until you actually test it and do, you know, use a bow of, for example, with the archery, use a bow with the same poundage, with the same type of heads, and see what damage they do, see what they will penetrate, see what they won't do. It's actually kind of trying to make these objects in the same way, as well as, you know, obviously kind of reenact it and demonstrate and show to the public. I like getting that information over there.
So, can you just talk me through Longbow?
Longbow. The longbow was I suppose, the great weapon of the Hundred Years' War, which lasted about 112 years. A kind of on and off war with France, so over a large period. It developed from, I mean, bows have always been used in battle right back from, you know, Saxon and Viking times even. They were used slightly on the periphery. Obviously, everybody knows about Harold and William and 1066 and all that. But it wasn't until, really, I suppose, Edward I started really organising the longbow and using them in mass ranks. And he developed this from being attacked by the Welsh. The Welsh were using longer bows, actually made of witch elm at the time, and ambushing these armoured knights. So you've got these, you know, relatively low status people using weapons that are very, very effective against the aristocracy on their, you know, their knights on horseback. And these people are meant to rule the battlefield. And yet these relatively highly skilled but lowly ranked people could take them out and be effective. So they started being brought into the army, and certainly by, say, Edward III, we then had a professional army. We didn't have a standing army, we had a professional army. You signed on the dotted line at sixpence a day to serve for 9 months or whatever. And you had to prove that you could use the bow and you know, that's what you did. So, I mean, from the Welsh bow, it developed into a longer and actually more powerful bow. The best ones were out of yew, which is a wonderful wood for making the bows, though actually quite difficult to work, because the heartwood, the inner part, is a kind of dark reddish colour and very, very hard, resists the compression, and then the outer sapwood holds the whole thing together, will stretch, and is quite elastic, so it acts like a kind of bimetallic spring, and that's why it's so good. Although saying that, for every, it was on the statute, for every bow that was made of yew, you had to make two of other woods. Normally, again, witch elm or possibly ash, something like that. And most of the yew was imported, first from Spain. So, except obviously when we started fighting Spain, they stopped selling us the wood, rather, because selling the country the weapons that they're then going to use against you is not a good idea, and I wish some of our politicians had learned from history. So then we started getting the wood from elsewhere. But hugely devastating weapon. People have got no idea of the power of these things. The large bows that up over £100 pull are absolutely devastating, you know, scary. Even to us who are used to them, they're scary. Very, very powerful.
What exactly are you planning on doing on the plinth with the longbow?
Well, obviously I'm not going to be shooting around Trafalgar Square, not the best idea. So I shall be fletching some arrows. So actually I've got some arrows kind of half prepared. The feathers just tacked in place, and I'll be whipping the feathers on. So actually, the feathers are always just tacked in place with the glue, and then literally tied onto the arrow shaft so they'd stay in place. And I'll be doing a little bit of that and explaining about that. And I've got a very large mock-up of an arrow so it can be seen from a distance as well, and putting them together. And seeing as I'm awake at 3 o'clock in the morning, I might as well get some work done.
So are you also interested in the kind of political climate of the period?
Well, you do. The more you get into it, you start off with, you know, you're interested in the longbow and how it works, and then you get, obviously, the big lollipop battles, the Agincourt, the Crecy, the Poitiers, you know, these big battles of the Hundred Years' War. But then you start reading about them, and obviously you think, well, why did these battles come about, and who were the characters who were involved, and why did they get into this situation? And obviously then you kind of go back in history 200 or 300 years, and you get the whole political situation going on, and then you get into the minutiae of how, you know, local administration and government was actually set up, and then you start going back through the parliament roles that are around, and there's some very good translations have come out quite recently of them. You know, we have all of these records, so it's the more you look at it, the more you get into, and you start, you know, getting further and further into it, and it is fascinating, but possibly a little bit too detailed to get over in an hour to talk. It's kind of how 14th century sheriffs were, you know, elected. It's not something everybody wants to know.
So how do you find your this interest of yours is normally received by other people?
Well, I've been doing this for quite a while now, so I've kind of paid my dues. I know what I'm doing, and so when I'm at a medieval show or a country fair or something, I can get over quite a lot quite quickly. I normally have, obviously, all my kit there. I've got the forge. I can make a simple arrowhead in front of them in a few minutes and then show them literally what that, normally a little armour-piercing arrowhead, will do. So I've got chainmail, I've got shields and armour that I can actually shoot through, and then I can show them some of the rapidity of the bow and, you know, shoot off 15, 18 arrows in a minute, and then show them some of the other weapons, the crossbows, the swords, that type of thing. So I can do kind of 20, 25 minutes, something like that, which can get an awful lot over. But then with the schools, I've got more chance to go over things a little bit slower and a little bit more detail, but also in a kind of more child-friendly way, and explain how, you know, castles work. It's brilliant if they do their school visit to a castle and I can be there. And I've got it fairly, you know, I've kind of been doing it long enough now to actually get that over quite well, I think. And it goes down very well. People are interested. And it's nice if they can. I don't put things behind glass. I like people to get hands-on as much as they can. You know, especially the children, they can look at anything in a glass box, but if you can actually pick it up, they, you know, appreciate it a lot more.
So do you have a completely different teaching method for children and for adults?
Yeah, you generally have to be a bit slower for adults. A lot of the kids are pretty bright. Not really. You know, obviously it depends on the age of the children. You know, when you're teaching kind of 10 and 11 year olds, you've got to do it a little bit different to 14, 15 year olds. But most of the time they're pretty good. Yeah, so you just, you know, slow down the language a bit and explain things a little more simply, but it's basically the same.
What are your hopes, fears, expectations for your time today?
Well, I'm hopeful and doesn't look like it's going to be raining, which was going to be the worst thing. drunk people coming out of bars throwing kebabs at me probably won't be the best idea, but I don't think that's going to be too bad. No, looking forward to it. I'm not afraid of heights. You know, I think it's going to be a good experience, a nice hour there. I've got supporters with me and a few people on online at home and in various countries around the planet hopefully watching me, and I might get a few emails through, and looking forward to it.
So is there anybody coming to watch you today?
I've got a mate with me, yes, who's been a real star. He's doing his medical training at the moment, so he's got lectures in Bristol all week, and he's got some tomorrow that he couldn't get out of, so he's come up on the train with me tonight. He's going back at 5:30 in the morning, and then he's coming back tomorrow night because we're having a weekend out in London. So he's an absolute star for doing it. So, I've left wife and children all at home to come and play.
Do you think this experience will have any kind of effect on you?
I hope so. I hope it'll be kind of quite positive. It's something else to do, isn't it? And, you've got to, you know, do these experiences, whether it's, as I say, you know, kind of getting up in a castle and shooting out of some tower that nobody's shot out of for 600 or 700 years, or you know, coming here and standing on a lonely fourth plinth at 3 o'clock in the morning in Trafalgar Square. It's another experience, and it's a different perspective on life, isn't it?
Well, thank you so much.
Pleasure.